today is, what is today? It's the 1st of March, although looking outside you couldn't tell. This is an interview with Barb Gerloff. Is that Barb? Is that how you say your last name?
Yep, Gerloff. Mm-hmm.
This is interviews being done primarily about Barb's time as an academic staff member here at UW-Madison. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives. Barb, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, it's Barbara Gerloff. It's G-E-R-L-O-F-F.
Okay, so full name is Barbara, but you go by Barb.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start at the beginning, Barb, because you were born here at the University Hospital. Obviously, you probably don't remember the exact event, but...
No, I don't.
But you have a family who were of campus then, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Your dad was a professor here?
My dad was a professor in the Department of Botany.
Okay.
And then my grandfather worked for UW Extension and had an office in Ag Hall and traveled around the state, was very involved with 4-H sorts of things too. Mm-hmm. So I've got a long history here.
Sure. So growing up, did you spend a lot of time on campus?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
What were some of the places you would hang out?
Well, in Burge Hall, where my dad worked, there was a big entry area off of Bascom Hill, and they had stuffed animal heads mounted on the balcony. And so when I was very little, that was just beyond exciting to run up the stairs and reach over and pat the animals on top. That was great fun. And I'm very animal oriented. Those are really my memories, and going out to the dairy and looking through the cows, the windows in the cows that they had made, mm-hmm. and where you could see the operation of their stomachs. And, mm-hmm. And then very much going down by the lake and the ducks and all that sort of thing.
So the dairy that was here on campus?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's mm-hmm. still on campus, but now it's subsumed by where there's a lot of stuff.
Right, but there were a lot of where you could actually go in and look at the cows and such.
Okay. You ended up matriculating here. Was that, did you have other possible options? Was it always going to be UW?
I was always interested in coming here. My interest was in music, but I wanted to teach, and so part of it was deciding whether I wanted to really go away to a really, really good music school or kind of push the education side of it more. And so my dad said, look, he said, you know, if you really are interested in going on in education, where you go to graduate school is much more critical in terms of long range things. So he said, if you want to go to Madison, that would be a good starting point for undergrad. And I applied other places and got admitted and such, but I kind of thought, maybe I'll just do this here. And I knew faculty in the School of Music already and such, so it wasn't a foreign land at all.
Sure.
So it was a very comfortable place to start and such. And then the education part of it was very good. So I that's why I kind of decided to do that.
Okay. When you matriculated here, did you stay on campus or did you stay with your parents?
My first year I stayed at home. And part of that was related to the fact that they had a piano at home, and because I had to do composition and I had to play piano, and because I was a voice major, so I could do all of my practicing without worrying about getting a practice room and being in the basement of Humanities, which is a wretched place. And so it was easy to do that way. And then what was nice about it is that the School of Music really provides a home. You know, everybody knows everybody because they're practicing all day together and they're in organizations together, tour together, and the curriculum is pretty similar, that everybody's got, you know, theory and music history and such. So it was very close-knit. So I didn't feel that, I felt very, very tied to campus and even though I was living at home, I think that's a little atypical than, you know, if you were an LNS student and just kind of commuting in and going to a big lecture and going home. So it was a very, very different experience that I had.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Who were some of the professors that influenced you when you were here?
Well, the basically all the voice faculty, Alona Combrink, I studied with her for a little bit, and I also took vocal literature from David Hotman, and then probably the most influential person was Robert Fountain, who was the big name choral director who had come from Oberlin, and he was just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So to be in his concert choir was, you know, the peak kind of choral experience you could have. So I sang in that group for 3 years, I think, and then we toured also, sang in Alice Tully Hall, New York City, Lincoln Center. It was great, great fun. So those were probably the ones that stand out for me, the faculty.
What about your cohort, people that you took classes with, students who stand out for one reason or another?
Well, the ones, I had, Ann Kaufman was a friend of mine from high school, and we sang in a barbershop quartet and choir together and such, and so she and I became very close when we were in high school, and then just kind of continued that at the university. And her father was a professor in the history department, and we shared an apartment and such. So she and we did a recital together, a joint recital. Yeah. So, Ann Kaufman, Carol Kruscher was also very important. The ones that stand out as a unique experience is that my sophomore year, I went into the dorm. I lived in Chet, and my roommate played the harp. The little harp players were very, very close, and they would go and play at events a lot. And so I'd be fast asleep in my room, and then all of a sudden the door would open, and they'd be on a dolly, and so I'd hear creak, 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 you know, in the middle of the night when she got back, and there would be this immense harp. It just filled up the entire dorm room, you know. So I lived with this, you know, harp that kind of appeared and disappeared, and, you know, in the morning she'd roll it across the street to the humanities building. It was very funny. And every once in a while, I think they'd even try and get two harps in, but so Karen Ott's was my roommate at Chad, and she still plays for the Madison Symphony. And Faye Seaman was another one, who one of the harp players. So they stand out, definitely.
Barb, I think I'd be remiss, even though your undergrad was, I think, basically either after the Vietnam War or towards the end of it, you were of Madison. Mm-hmm. During the 60s and
sure.
Through Sterling Hall bombings. So I wonder if mm-hmm. you have just general ideas or strong memories about the student protests of that time period.
Oh, very much so, because my dad worked in Burge Hall, so he got gassed. And his lab was destroyed in the bombing. So I remember hearing it. I woke up and I thought, well, you know, in the middle of the night, I thought, what was that? And then the telephone rang, and my dad went down and trying to figure out what the heck had happened. The thing that I remember so much about it, the bombing itself, was, you know, that all the glass was gone. In Menfleck, you know, the glass was gone. It was just gone. And one of the things my dad said is that in his lab, you know, they all have so much glassware, and it had all somehow, with the drawers being thrown open and the shards of glass going around at the same time is that every single drawer was filled with little bitty pieces and sharp glass and such. So the cleanup was just unbelievable that had to be done. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure my mother could tell more about that, but that's what I remember as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Remember. So you were a teenager, right? 14, 15,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah. And then I my dad and I went to some of the big protests at the field house, you know, the rallies and marching up to the Capitol and the candlelight march and such. So we were very involved that way. So I felt very, very connected to the campus and what was going on, and went down, you know, you ride the bus down and kind of like the protest of the day. So, oh yeah, I was there. I had my little peace button. I thought I was just beyond cool, you know, because, you know, I was in Madison anyway, so I felt very much a kindred spirit to what was going on. But I was just a babe, really, you know.
Barb, a couple of specific things. Where did your family live in 1970?
We lived off of near the Vitense Gulf Range, off of Whitney Way.
Sure. So a few miles from Sherman Hall.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we found out about the bombing of Wee, but just sort of general, mm-hmm. as we've been gathering histories, is that people a long ways away, several miles away, heard something.
Yeah, so something. I mean, I woke up. And
right.
Something was not okay.
And it sounds like, am I safe to say that you were anti-war at the time? Peace button?
Oh yes, absolutely. There was no question. Oh, very much so. Very much so, yeah.
So what did your dad, it's obviously difficult to speak for somebody else, particularly since you were sort of a teenager at that time, but did the bomb change how your dad perceived?
Oh, not at all.
Okay.
No. I mean, he didn't care for all the... I mean, he was a very, very logical person, you know, so... And very rational. So the idea of going and doing that, you know, it's like, well, what are you going to gain from that? So all of the radical stuff just violated that kind of rational, we need to sit down and work this out kind of thing, and running around bombing buildings seemed to be very stupid as a way of really having a functioning society. So it was just, I don't think that affected any of his views. He just didn't care for any of those radical groups because it just didn't, it seemed just completely ineffective. And
so. Do you recall being involved in any when you were undergrad? I know that Sterling Hall sort of sucked the big protests out, but do you recall being involved in any protests when you were here taking classes?
Well, there were when I was a first year, maybe there was, I can't even remember if it was a TA issue or it was a war issue. I can't even remember, but I was in one of my classes in the humanities building, and there was a great deal of fussing going on about protests, and all of a sudden somebody burst into the room and wrote whatever the issue was on the blackboard, you know, in big, big letters, and then ran out. And we were just all kind of sitting there like, well, thanks, you know. I mean, I think they were encouraging us to leave and go protest or something, but we were all just kind of frozen. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, felt very sophisticated, like, oh yes, well, this is a protest, and I've been there before for the real ones, you know, so I wasn't, you know, overly rattled, but I think some people really were, you know.
I think so.
You know, people barging into your classroom. Mm-hmm.
So Barb, as you were getting your undergraduate degree, what were your thoughts for the future in terms of, I mean, were you going to graduate school in music?
Well, I thought I would teach K-12, you know, in the public schools for a while, and then probably come back and get a master's degree, at least. Whether I would then return to the classroom or go on and maybe do a PhD in music ed or something was something that, you know, I was just kind of set on that course to kind of do step one, which is to go out there and teach, get your credibility, see what's going on, see if you really like this. So that was my goal, was to just get in the classroom.
So then what brought you to your work here?
Well, I was teaching up in Superior, and I lost my job because it was recession. And so they eliminated, you know, a lot of the special subject areas, you know, the art and the music and PE. And I was the lowest one on the last one hired, so off I went. And I had gotten very interested in administration, and partially because I thought the principals were not uniformly wonderful up there. I thought, are there ways to do this better? So I started thinking about that. And then I found out that there was this whole area of higher education administration. And I thought, I love this idea of college and how do you organize a college and a university? And I always thought you had to be faculty, you know, because my dad was. And so I just thought everybody was a faculty person. So I didn't really know about academic staffish sorts of people, really. There were PhD candidate grad students. They did a lot of teaching and TAs. But I didn't know of this whole level of employees at the university at all. So I just got interested in that kind of, you know, higher ed administration was very interesting. So I came back to do a degree in that then through what was educational administration, and I got hired by the School of Music to teach a couple of courses for elementary teachers, wannabes, who needed to have a music, how to teach music course. So they weren't music majors. They were elementary ed majors who had to do that. And that was great fun. Great fun. And so I taught there maybe three semesters. And then I also taught a very interesting course for music majors on American folk instruments, because music teachers, they wanted to make sure, had some understanding of auto harp and dulcimers and ukuleles and guitars. And so these were people who were really good musicians. And we just cranked through all of these different instruments. It was just more fun. We took our ukuleles and sang around the fountain in the mall and, you know, tiptoed through the tulips and all this. So, I mean, we just really, really had a great time. So I was in this funny combination of being teaching in the School of Music, and yet then I was doing a degree in educational administration. And so after I did that, taught for a couple of years, then I got employed to as a program assistant, I think it was, which was 75% time advising education students. So that was as a grad student, so I did that, and then really, really liked working with people, really liked that age. I love teaching college-level kids, and so I thought, well, I'll just keep doing this until I get bored, and I still work there.
Mm-hmm. And that started in 87. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're past now a quarter of a century.
Yeah. So I was a grad student program assistant for a while, and then I got hired as academic staff full time in that job as a student services coordinator in 87. But I've been a grad student assistant since, I think, 84.
Okay. There. All right, so in a sense, you've been working here since 84.
Right.
Were you teaching in
84? Well, 82 when I came back, okay, and went with
so
the school.
So 82 teaching for a while, then 84, and then 87 is when you sort of full-time academic staff.
Yeah, okay. Became a real person again. a real job.
So, again, we don't have to be specific with dates, but you started in 87. When did you, roughly how long after that did you start becoming involved in academic staff governance issues or academic staff committees or things like that?
I was afraid you'd ask that. It was a long time.
Okay, so it took a while then.
Yeah, okay. I didn't really know that much about it, that there was anything to be involved in, you know. So I don't know, I probably really didn't get involved until maybe 2005-ish.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, in those, you know, decade and a half or so, I assume you were moving up the ladder, so to speak, within, it's now called the Education Academic Services,
right.
But it was called something
Education Student Services.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when did you eventually become associate dean, or is it
assistant,
director?
Well, I was assistant director.
Okay.
And then last year moved into an assistant dean title.
Okay. All right, so let's go back then to academic staff governance or committees.
All right.
So it was around mid-2000s.
Yeah.
What did you become involved in first?
Well, let's see. I think I started because somebody asked if I would be involved with the Madison Academic Staff Association.
Okay.
And would I be interested in running for an office? And I said I didn't even know what it was. But it was kind of funny because I was kind of the next generation. Bob Miller was the person who was the assistant director in the office where I worked, and he became the first secretary of the academic staff. So I knew Bob did things, you know, with academic staff. But then somebody asked me, but then he moved up into Bascom and then retired, and so that wasn't a huge influence for me getting involved. It was more that I became aware of it. So I was about maybe 10 or 15 years younger than the people who really kind of started all this. So Shar Tortorisi and Steve Safian and Bob Miller and Ann Wallace, a lot of the people who were very, very involved in the initial shared governance implementation kinds of things were people I knew and were friends, and I knew Colleen McCabe. So they were kind of my friends, Barry Robinson, but they kind of did this thing and I didn't really know what it was, and I was just kind of the next generation. So when they asked if I would be interested, the people who were on the board of MASA were, I mean, Barry Robinson and Colleen McCabe and Al Friedman, Shar was involved, or were the advisory board. So it was at that point that I just kind of got brought in to the fold. And so that was that, you know. And of course, once they got me in, they weren't going to let me go.
Yeah. What sort of either leadership positions or committees have you been
have
involved?
I been on?
Yeah.
So
which one stand out, maybe?
Well, I think because I then became, I was president-elect when I first got it kind of scooped up. And so so I was president of that the following year, and then past president, so that was a 3-year stint. And then I became involved in the CASI, in the School of Education. And then I became involved with the Academic Staff Appeals Committee. So I've served on that for any number of years now, and I'm co-chair of that. And along the way, they needed somebody to be on the nominating committee as well, so I'm in my second three-year stint on that committee as well. So then I've been on the assembly for a couple terms as well.
Staff assembly.
Yeah. But I got scooped onto committees way before I actually was on the assembly, so I kind of did it a little bit differently than I think a lot of people do. It's, they say, get involved in the CASI, get, you know, be an assembly rep, and then keep branching out and such. So I kind of did it the opposite way. So.
What are some of the, or have there been some key issues in the last almost decade or so affecting either academic staff or governments or academic staff in general?
Key issues?
Or just something that, you know, you may not have been directly involved in, but you know it affects how you, how we do our work.
Well, when I first got involved in all this, I was very struck by how, no matter where we started, in a meeting or at a conference or whatever, eventually we always seem to come back to two huge issues. One is that academic staff were so disparate. So we've got researchers, and we've got teachers, and we've got, I mean, instructors, and then we've got people who are doing all the student services kind of work. And the, just the cultural mindsets of each of those three areas are just so very different. And who are, and so one of the ongoing issues to me is that, you know, how do we create a real peer group? Who, you know, together, when you've got people whose, they see themselves as kind of their peer group or other Research One institution academic staff. That's who they email, that's who they, whose articles they're reading, that's whose research they're working on together, you know, I mean, on research projects. So then you've got people who are instructional staff, who are very department focused. And so it's always been very hard, and it just seems like that has just been this ongoing issue of creating a solid block. That's always been a real challenge, which then I think affects the ability of academic staff to really mobilize, you know, to do something. Because if people literally don't even know their academic staff, you know, they just say, well, I'm in the French department. I mean, they don't even know who their peers are. And if someone told them, I think they'd be surprised that they've got a kinship with somebody who works in residence halls, you know, when they're in a physics research. So that has been one thing that I've just always kind of been interested in, that it just seems no matter where we start, it ends up, what do we do about this? And in particular, how do we get the researchers involved on committees, interested in, engaged and such, when they're so steeped in what they're doing and who they're doing it with? That's just been an ongoing issue. The other one that I have always been, felt like we would always get down to, was that the people who were assisting in real research projects and such were frequently feeling very abused by the PI and feeling that there was no recourse. There was no restitution for this, that it wasn't illegal. They just weren't treated well. And because they were part of this person's project and they were the grant getter, and they were in charge, and the university thought they were pretty spiffy and wanted to keep them, that there was no recourse. And that there was, in fact, it seemed like there was more recourse in the classified staff system than for academic staff. So it just seemed like these ongoing, I thought, not just whining, but very, very substantive concerns got unresolved. And there was no mechanism to resolve them. Classified staff have, just for example, have work rules, you know, which just says, essentially, you need to treat people decently. You know, there's some basic work expectations here as to how you are going to be conducting yourself and what your staff can expect. We don't have that for academic staff. So there's never been some, that's been a concern for me all along. That's not the current, you know, we've had to, it's not the pension and the health insurance, the big issues now. Those are just kind of obviously hot political issues right now, and what's our future as academic staff, and how is the new HR system going to help or hinder? I don't know. It's a big, big question mark. So.
Right. Robbie, you talked about one of the issues being a relationship with, you know, academic staff and the PI on whatever project you're on. A similar type question specifically for you, and that's your relationship, if you had one, with the deans of the college, particularly the College of Education.
School of Education.
School of Education, excuse me. How was your relationship, if you had one, with the various deans that you've served under?
As in any kind of formal academic staff capacity,
well,
or just my relationship
both,
with...
Both in terms of, you know, you being an academic staff, but also just you being a, you know, employee. So that sort of relationship, has those relationships been...
My own personal, I can tell you about my own personal experiences.
Why don't we start there?
Yeah, we'll start there. I have lived a charmed life. All right, that way. And it's just because I grew up here. And so the first dean when I was hired was John Palmer. And he had a background that was very similar to my father. He was an Illinois farm boy. My dad was a Nebraska farm boy. I felt I understood him, you know. He very much had a lot of the same integrity and thoughtfulness that I always felt very happy to work for him, because I felt he was a good man, you know. And he was also my mother and his wife were very good friends as well. So I felt like I was very lucky that way as well. But I mean, we weren't, I don't think he was so close to my parents, but his wife was. And so he knew who I was, irregardless of my position. He just knew I was Jerry and Mary Ellen's daughter. So that was a little unusual. Then Henry Trueba, was the dean then, and he had very, very little interest in the student services area, period. So I don't remember him really. I'm sure he didn't know my name, which wasn't personal. He never even came in the office, as far as I know. So it just was not his thing.
Getting a little loud.
Yeah. And he didn't stay very long either.
Okay.
So I don't know if he had stayed 10 years, that would have changed as well. He's got bigger fish to fry than people who are doing advising for undergrads when you come in as a new dean.
Right.
From and he was from outside, so he had a great deal just to learn about the campus and such. So, so there was I didn't have much. Then we had Chuck Reed, and who came from the graduate school, and he was also a wonderful person to work for. He knew everybody's name very quickly, greeted people in the hall. I think he very much had a feeling that he was, or it communicated anyway, that we were part of his responsibility. And I felt very much that he put his arms around our office as part of his responsibility to learn people's names and such. I think overall we were, the deans like it when students are not unhappy because then their parents and legislators don't call. And so there's a, I think that we've not been starved out budget-wise. I think we've been supported very well by our deans, because of the support that we give to our students. And so I think there's been, you know, the downside of that is it's kind of like, just go do your thing. You know, we kind of don't want to know all that much. Just do it well and we'll keep funding it. And they've been overall across the board quite supportive. Julie Underwood is, I actually had, when she was a brand new instructor here, I was in, I think, her first law class that she taught in Ed Admin. And so we kind of hit it off and when I was a grad student. So she went off and did her thing and such, and lo and behold, she ended up coming back and being the dean. So I felt like I had a very, very long relationship with her before she became the dean. So it's just a kind of a kooky, charmed life just by virtue of the people that happened to become dean. I know my mother was involved again with Chuck Reed's wife in the University League and, you know, and such. So I felt like I've been very, very lucky that way. I would feel by virtue of my own standing and the combination that I had a history with the campus that I could have very readily made an appointment and have been heard with any one of them. So
Barb, I want to back up before we kind of do our final thoughts. It might be important to why it is important to have you tell me, the recorder, future generations, some of the things you do in education academic services.
Well, fundamentally, our office has two main areas of focus. One is advising students who are interested in education programs. And in our School of Education, we have teacher education programs, but then we also have the art department and kinesiology. We have rehabilitation psychology, all of which, and dance, which are not related to teaching certificates or anything. So we advise for all of those programs. And we do admissions work into them. We do graduation checks and all of that. So if you wanted to be an elementary ed teacher and wanted to come back, you'd come and talk to us.
Okay.
So we do a lot of work with just advising. prospective students, current ones, and people who might want to come back. The other main division has to do with field experiences, and that's working with the schools to provide student teaching and practicum opportunities for our teachers as they're going through their programs. So there's a lot of work negotiating that as well. So I'm more personally in the advising side than the placement part of that. Okay. So the work I do, I used to have an assigned student load, of advisees, which I don't anymore, given the other responsibilities. So fundamentally, what I spend a lot of time doing is going to meetings, and I track requirements and new programs, kind of often from just somebody has an idea about changing the elementary ed program, for example, or doing some rethinking about the kinesiology department offerings. So I'm often brought in at a very, elementary level in some of those discussions. So I work with that, and then through the whole approval process. So I sit on a lot of programs committee meetings, School of Ed Programs Committee, which is the curriculum approval. And then I also do the degree audit in coding and the catalog and such. So it's all the way from, we think we might want to do this, all the way through getting the approval process and making it real for students and producing documents that they use through the degree audit and then such. So that's my main, what the heck is going on? What do we offer? Who does it apply to? This new change, all of that kind of thing. In addition, I obviously do assistant dean things, which I fill in for everything from sitting at the front desk to advising appointments. I fill in for the associate dean when he can't make a meeting. Mm-hmm. And then I supervise the person that does admissions and the person who, the administrative assistant that works with all the front desk student workers and such. So
over the, you're now 25 years here, am I correct in saying you're working less and less with students one-on-one?
Direct contact. Yeah, the percentage of the day. I still see, the kooky situations where, someone's really in trouble or needs to get out of trouble or whatever.
We're talking academic trouble.
Oh, it can be about anything.
It could be about any kind of trouble. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you miss the interaction with the students? Mm-hmm. Or?
I get enough of it, but they provide energy. That's why I never leave. I've never left. Every time I go to SOAR in the summer, and you see these little bright faces, these high school kids coming in, and they're just so full of themselves that they've graduated from high school, and then there's often, at least one adult looking vaguely like the kid, coming in also. It totally wipes out all the cynicism. It does, every year. It's all brand new. New people who are experiencing their years on campus and passing that baton and saying, you really need to try this, or you should see this, and seeing that kind of magic is just it's great. And people say, I never leave. I couldn't even think of this. And other people ask, how could you possibly do this for so long? It's like, how could you not?
Barb, always try to make sure you have the last word. So we made it 45 minutes.
But
I want to make sure that if there's anything on your mind about, you've been of this campus really since you were born. So anything on your mind you might want to get onto the record before we shut it down.
My final words.
Exactly.
My last lecture.
Yes.
Ah. Well,
I mean, in a sense, what you just said there was.
I think it's a very magical place. And I think it's been magical for a lot of the, quote, progressive sorts of ideals that have been realized on this campus. Part of that is just the accessibility of people to each other. You know, when I said I feel like I could make an appointment with any of the deans and be able to A, make the appointment and be heard. And the fact that Robert Fountain, who he was telling about, is this fabulous choral conductor, he'd just hop on the bus, you know, after work, and we'd all ride home together, you know, the students, and he'd be there and such. And all the kooky things that happen and such, it's very magical. When I talk to prospective students who are thinking of coming here, you know, and their parents, and I said, you know, I keep trying to find words to describe our students, you know, that are going to try and characterize the place. And I think one of the things that helps them understand how Madison might be maybe a little different from other schools or whatever from a student standpoint is that I tell them that I feel that our students do whatever they do with a great deal of enthusiasm, whatever they do, with a lot of oomph. And that can be drinking, you know, but it can also be winning some super engineering competition. It can also be this, it can also be that, all of which are approached with the same amount of enthusiasm and attention to detail and willingness to spend a great deal of time at it. And I think it's this kind of across-the-board enthusiasm that I feel is wonderful and unique about coming to school here and the experience that people have. And when they leave, they come back. A lot of the parents, you know, are alums. And it's like they catch fire again when I start talking about that. And they'll say, oh yeah, you know, we did this. And someone else said, yes, you know, and we did this. And oh, did we get in trouble? And you know, I said, yep, lots of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of characterizes it for me, that people care about whatever they're involved in deeply. It's not a whatever kind of place. And that's kept something I really want to see continue and keep alive.
Great. Barb, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Troy.